From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern made a major announcement today in response to the mosque attacks that left 50 people dead less than a week ago in Christchurch.
Today I'm announcing that New Zealand will ban all military-style semi-automatic weapons. We will also ban all assault rifles. We will ban all high-capacity magazines.
Joining us now is CNN senior international correspondent Ivan Watson. He's in Christchurch. Hi, Ivan.
Hi there, Jeremy.
And first of all, just tell us more about what the Prime Minister had to say today.
She announced a ban on semi-automatic weapons, on assault rifles, on magazines that can carry a lot of ammunition, and on the parts that can modify a weapon. And basically, she was making the argument that the kinds of weapons that were used to carry out the deadliest terrorist attack in New Zealand's modern history, that they will all be banned now. So a dramatic move. And it's before even the families of the victims have all been able to bury their dead, to give you a sense of how quickly this government has moved here.
Mm-hmm. And the funeral's going on today and as we speak. But how is this going to work? Are gun owners in New Zealand just going to have to turn in their weapons?
That's basically what they're going to try to do. And there are a lot of guns here per capita. The government's estimates are between 1.2 and 1.5 million guns for a population of just under 5 million. One gun for every four people, roughly. I don't know how many of those fall into the newly banned categories, but they're introducing a number of measures. They say they've already been urging people to voluntarily surrender their guns to the police. They say they will embark on some kind of a buyback scheme, and they're estimating that'll cost between the equivalent of $70 and $140 million. They say that they'll have a website up by this weekend so that gun owners can register, because as of 3 p.m. on Thursday, the police say if you had one of these guns, one of these assault rifles, they are now illegal. You can't even carry them around. And they say that they're going to increase the penalties if you're caught with one of these firearms. But there's an amnesty period. There's going to be a transition period for this to fully go into effect. And they seem to be modeling some of this on what Australia did after a gun massacre in Port Arthur in 1996, a similar kind of buyback scheme and tightening the gun regulations.
Ivan, as you know, if after a mass shooting in the United States, like Sandy Hook, like the one in Orlando, like the one in Las Vegas, if something like this were to be done, there would be enormous pushback from gun owners and from people in this country. What kind of pushback is there in New Zealand?
So far, it's been minimal. The leader of the opposition party has even endorsed this. The deputy prime minister, who after the Orlando nightclub shooting spoke out against gun control measures like this, he is part of the government that is implementing these changes. We've reached out to groups like the Auckland Rifle Club, and they have said they support the government's measures. And I think that says something about how truly traumatized and shocked this entire country is by the scale of the violence here. And this is a country with a large agricultural sector, huge expanses of rural area. The government has said that there will be exemptions for hunters, for farmers who have to engage in pest control. But it does seem that the shock and the trauma has been so extreme that there is some kind of moment of consensus for the time being to enact these dramatic changes.
Meanwhile, as you said, people are remembering those who died in the shooting. How is the country going to mark the attacks tomorrow, which is 1 week since they happened?
Well, you know what? If you were a white supremacist who supported this kind of act of terror, you failed terribly in New Zealand, because on Friday, they're going to have a 2 minute moment of silence across the nation. They're going to broadcast the Muslim call to prayer on the national television and radio stations. And I can't say enough about just the outpouring of love and support that we've seen from people here in Christchurch for the tiny Muslim minority. It makes up about 1% of the population here in New Zealand that was so savagely targeted on Friday. This is a country that continues to say that all the different demographics in the society, they are all one. And it's been really something to see. I'll just give you one anecdote. Saturday night, I saw a man drunkenly stumbling home from some bar in the middle of the night, see a man who was visibly Muslim and just walked up to him and hugged him. Even when somebody drunk coming home from the bars is that touched. I mean, that just, to me, that anecdote helps summarize the outpouring here. And we're still seeing people weeping at the makeshift memorial that's been erected by the Botanic Garden day after day, bringing up cards and notes and stuffed animals and lighting candles for the victims.
That is CNN senior international correspondent Ivan Watson joining us from Christchurch, New Zealand. Ivan, thank you so much.
You bet, Jeremy.
Well, here in the States, former Congressman and current presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke is acknowledging that as a teen, he was a member of one of the most famous American hacking groups, the Cult of the Dead Cow, which was named after an abandoned slaughterhouse in Lubbock, Texas. At one point, the group's hacking forced Microsoft to boost its security for the Windows program. But O'Rourke told Reuters reporter Joseph Menn, who's written a new book on the Cult of the Dead Cow, that he only did things like steal long-distance phone service to go online. Lily Hay Newman is a staff writer at Wired Magazine in New York. Lily, this has got the hacker and IT world chattering, but others are asking, what is the Cult of the Dead Cow? So remind us.
Yeah, Cult of the Dead Cow was a hacking collective started in 1984, so spanning, you know, particularly active in the 80s and 90s, early 2000s. They did some hacking, but they also were sort of a thought collective using bulletin board systems, which were, you know, the Facebook or the social media of the 80s. And so Cult of the Dead Cow was really big on writing stories, commentary, doing interviews, and getting their thoughts out there. Mm-hmm. So there was the sort of technical hacking component that is sort of fun or sinister or, you know, depending on what you think about it. But there was also online discussion and thought in a way that we take for granted now, but was new.
Well, Beto O'Rourke has said to, again, reporter Joseph Menn, that that's why he went on. He wanted to join these bulletin boards. Now, Menn, when he was working on his book, knew that a former member of the cult was in Congress, but members of the cult protected his secret for decades and then started claiming him when Beto O'Rourke decided to run for president. Menn interviewed O'Rourke before his Texas Senate race, way back then, for the book, and didn't report on it then. Maybe part of a deal to get the interview with him. But what is he saying that Beto O'Rourke told him?
So Beto O'Rourke went by the handle Psychedelic Warlord. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little unfortunate of a choice now for, you know, his presidential run, but, you know, totally fits into the context of everyone had, you know, these sort of wild handles, or if you think about, you know, hacker names. And he seems to have mostly just been taking advantage of these bulletin board systems and text files to do some writing, do some thinking about dystopian future or utopian future, what the world might be like. He wrote about what would it be like to be in a world without money? And he also did an interview with a white supremacist and Nazi sympathizer trying to figure out why this person thought what he thought. And he says at the time that they were just trying to kind of get him to hang himself with his own words or something, you know, just show people what this is all about. So it's sort of a range of things. And O'Rourke told Joseph Menn that, you know, is trying to connect with people and to connect with the community and just explore what was out there.
Well, as we said, he also, you know, admitted that he pilfered long distance service so he wouldn't run up the phone bill. He found sites that offered cracked software to get cracked video games, games that he could get into, but told Menn he later realized that wasn't morally defensible. He was young. It's at most a misdemeanor and a fine. Some have speculated that this might actually be a positive for him, since so many lawmakers know so little about how technology works. On the other hand, hacker has a negative connotation. What is your sense of what the fallout of this is going to be now and when this book comes out in June?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when you think about, okay, cracked video games, something like that. Now, it's really common. Everybody probably has themselves or knows someone who has pirated a TV show or downloaded a piece of software and used a code from a friend. So we're all kind of hackers in the, you know, 1980s teen Beto sense. But Joseph Menn tweeted that the reaction to the story and, you know, to this information has been sort of wildly varied, which I think speaks to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Some people view it as a really cool, positive thing that he is connected to the reality of what's going on in tech, what's going on the internet. Some people view it as really threatening and immoral, or, you know, that he had done things that are illegal or wrong. So I think you're just going to get the gamut of reactions. But certainly hacker culture is a lot more accepted now than ever.
Sure. As Menn says, this would have been unthinkable that a hacker would be running for president years ago. Lily Hay Newman, staff writer with Wired, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Remember a while back, the Los Angeles Police Department revealed portraits done by convicted serial killer Samuel Little of up to 90 additional women he claimed he'd killed. They wanted to try to crowdsource the identification of those women to see if they could solve any cold cases. You may have scanned the pictures hoping you could help, but it made us wonder about collectors who might also be looking at them, hoping they could someday collect them. That's right. It's a field. It's called murderabilia, the collecting of items from killers, letters they wrote from jail, or paintings by killers like John Wayne Gacy, who sexually assaulted and murdered at least 33 teens and young men between 1972 and 78 in Cook County, Illinois, and was known for dressing as a clown called Pogo at charity events. Well, he began painting clowns while in prison. In a few minutes, we're going to meet a former probation officer who first coined the phrase murderabilia and was successful in getting it banned from eBay. But ironically, that drove sellers and collectors to different websites. I know you may be thinking what we were. Isn't it illegal for inmates to profit from their fame? We'll take that up in a minute. But first, William Harder, who runs the website murderauction.com. He's a collector who also sells items from serial killers. William, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Ms. Young.
Why do you do this?
I guess to make it as short of an answer as possible, I just have an interest in true crime that kind of went this way. It started with me corresponding with inmates, you know, offering a friendship, a correspondence, and it kind of went to me beginning to visit. Then I started receiving, you know, gifts of artwork, and before long, I decided I wanted to start collecting this, and it's just kind of snowballed, if you will, from there.
Do I understand that you visited Charles Manson in prison, and he made string art?
Yes.
Yeah. You know that people think that's not only ghoulish, but it is giving these horrendous killers sort of a humanity that they don't deserve.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, you're saying if a person's convicted of a crime, they don't deserve humanity. So, I mean, are you saying that you're in favor of solitary confinement with, you know, stripping, you know, every basic civil right, you know, like stuff they do in like North Korea?
But this is different. This is selling the artwork. In some cases, the artwork is glorifying the killing that they did. There's, for instance, the face of a woman as she's being murdered that was painted by her murderer. That's what people object to, especially since we know that some of the people who buy this, who are attracted to serial killers, are also attracted to what they do.
First, selling artwork isn't glorifying anybody's in particular crimes. That's like saying if you know, was the U.S. government glorifying the Unabomber crimes when they auctioned off all of his possessions? Are we glorifying the Holocaust when people are spending, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on paintings by Adolf Hitler?
Some would say yes.
I get that. As I'm fond of saying, victims' rights end where my rights begin. If you don't like it, I hate to sound cold or callous, but don't buy it.
Who profits from this? I'm looking at the Pogo the Clown from John Wayne Gacy oil painting. You've listed it at $7,900.
Well, hang on. I didn't. You have to realize murder auction works a lot like eBay. I'm not in control of that auction. That belongs to another individual. And I mean, while I can't be sure who is profiting from that, but I can tell you this much. John Wayne Gacy isn't going to make a dime. Most of these guys have absolutely no idea their items are even being hawked. In fact, in the little world of collectors, There's a sort of code of silence because most collectors will write as a person that they are not. Men generally take on female personas to obtain the trust of people who, like you said, have been denied basic compassion, humanity. And sometimes, you know, this went on, you know, starting at, you know, very young age, like being sexually assaulted by their parents, witnessing violence, you know, as they grew up, and then ultimately ending up in prison for a violent crime. They have no idea that their items are being hawked.
Well, you're absolutely right. But can you understand, you know, I'm looking at the case of Alina Semender. She was one of the victims of Carl Eugene Watts. He killed 11. Her mom had just gotten over that maybe years later, setting the table for her daughter every night, forgetting she was not there, when a letter surfaced that he had written from jail and it was being auctioned off. For her, it was tumbling back all over again.
I mean, I'm sorry for her loss, but I don't really know how to respond.
Do you worry about who these people are that are using your website?
I worry more about, you know, the death threats. It could be from, a 15-year-old kid with nothing better to do. It could be coming from somebody who legitimately wants to see my family members harmed so I can understand their pain.
Well, I'm sorry you're getting death threats, but we still have to ask, if you ever came across someone on your site that you thought had too much of an interest in a serial killer, would you contact authorities?
Too much of an interest? There's more books about serial killers than American presidents. I mean, look at popular television, you know, fictitious shows like Dexter and CSI. I mean, we're talking primetime television. You have tons of documentary films about different serial killers, historical serial killers, modern serial killers. And again, these are all people that are celebrated in the press. And if I question something, I mean, I always remind people, I go, this isn't a democracy. I go, I have a, you know, integrity to protect and a membership base to protect. So yeah, if I think something's questionable, you got to go.
That's William Harder. Again, his website is murderauction.com. William, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you again for having me.
Well, let's bring in Andy Kahn, a longtime victims advocate for the city of Houston. He now works with Crime Stoppers in Houston. And as we said, he came up with the phrase murderabilia. Andy, you know William Harder, who's visited 90 convicted killers, and he asks, don't they deserve the humanity that artwork gives them? You say what?
I can tell you the bottom line is, by allowing them to sell their goods, you continue to feed into their ego and make them feel relevant. Years ago, we had a serial killer in Houston, Angel Resendez Ramirez, better known as the Railway Killer. Mm-hmm. And once he got wind of how famous he was quoted, and I use his quote in my lectures, saying he will no longer sign anything for less than $50 because he's famous now. Mm-hmm. And sadly, he was correct.
Well, we just heard from William that many times these killers don't know their items are being sold, that they're getting duped by people who write them and say that they want something that's signed. And
that's actually factually correct. Yeah. I want to say it's pretty much about 50-50. About half of the killers are aware that their stuff is being sold and they actually enter into some sort of contractual agreements. And quite frankly, the other half is clueless. Years ago, I sent out 20 letters to high-profile serial killers all across the country, identifying myself, what I do, had items being sold with their names on it, and was asked them for their perspective on it. And actually, in the course of now going on 15 years, one of the most infamous, notorious serial killers has been corresponding with me and has been one of the greatest assets I've ever had to combat the murderabilia industry. And he was absolutely stunned to find out his stuff was being sold without his permission.
Can we know who he is?
Yes. None other than the son of Sam himself, David Berkowitz. It doesn't get any better when you have whom all the profiting laws are named after, also known as the son of Sam laws, actually working on your behalf and with you to curb the industry of killers profiting from their notoriety.
But where are we on the law? Because, yes, there are the Son of Sam laws that forbid people who committed heinous crimes from profiting from them in any way, selling books, selling artwork. But we understand
those. That's actually factually inaccurate.
Well, I was going to say,
and
it's been overturned.
Like many other, I was shocked to find out the Son of Sam laws were actually ruled unconstitutional.
That's right. Right.
In 1991, in a famous case that actually involved a mafia informant by the name of Henry Hill, whom most of your listeners will probably recognize as the lead character in the movie Goodfellas. Mm-hmm. The Son of Sam laws were ruled unconstitutional because they restricted free speech.
You know, as you said, we were shocked too. We thought the Son of Sam laws
yes.
meant that you couldn't profit from a crime.
Most people are under the delusion that you can't sell your rights for books and movies, but I can tell you recent court cases have all voted in favor of convicted criminals.
Even if there may be separate state laws?
If it has the language dealing with free speech, which is why I started crafting legislation that I call notoriety for profit laws. In other words, talk all you want, scratch, sniff, paint, doodle, you just don't profit from it.
What about something else that William Harder just said to us? He says it's us, you know, meaning media, that's celebrating these people and leading people to want a piece of them.
You know, and there's some parts that William says I totally agree with. Absolutely. When you look at the entertainment industry in America, for the most part, it thrives on one word. That's murder. Mm. True crime is now in vogue or in genre, and victims are basically treated with what I call disinstitutionalized disinterest.
So obviously you're working on laws that skirt that question of freedom of speech. But in the meantime, what do victims' families tell you the impact of this is?
I can tell you from serving on the board of the Houston chapter of Parents of Murdered Children for about 25 years, it is the most nauseating and disgusting feeling in the world when you find out the person who murdered one of your loved ones now has items being hawked by third parties for pure profit. It's like being gutted all over again by our criminal justice system. No one should be able to rob, rape, and murder and then turn around and make a buck off of it. I'm a firm believer in free enterprise and capitalism. But I do think you have to draw the line somewhere. And where I and many others draw the line is the issue of profiting off of crime.
That's Andy Kahn, a longtime victims advocate, and he works now with Crime Stoppers in Houston, Texas. Andy, thank you.
My pleasure.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Shares of the biotech company Biogen fell nearly 30% when the market opened this morning on news that the company is discontinuing trials on a much-hyped Alzheimer's drug. The drug, which is known as aducanumab, was in phase 3 trial, the last stage before FDA approval. For more, let's go to Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Jeremy.
So getting an effective Alzheimer's drug on the market is one of the biggest, most elusive goals in pharma research. But why were people betting on this particular drug?
I mean, because Biogen had gone so far down the approval process with Wall Street and families of those suffering from Alzheimer's, which has been such a hopeless affliction. They were putting so much hope into what was expected to be a blockbuster. Goldman Sachs had pegged potential sales at about $12 billion just for this one drug.
So why did they give up then?
Management says that the decision to stop was based on an independent group's analysis that showed that the trials were unlikely to, quote, meet their primary endpoint. And Biogen did reiterate that, you know, you're not talking about safety concerns here, but the longer the expectation continues, the more blowback a publicly traded corporation like Biogen is going to get by not being totally forthcoming about this drug's path to market. Again, this was expected to be a blockbuster. You don't see moonshots like this in stage three all that often.
And just to put the failure in context, 99% of Alzheimer's drug trials have failed over the last 15 years. What do we know about why this disease in particular is so hard to treat?
Yeah, it's such a nasty shape-shifting target. I mean, much of the research into potential Alzheimer's drugs focuses on the buildup in the human brain of beta amyloid. And that combating that sticky substance could help sufferers, you know, both current and future. This is a big setback today for that hypothesis. I mean, Pfizer said last year that it would stop trying to discover new Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease drugs outright. And to date, no drugs have been approved to treat the underlying causes of Alzheimer's.
Now, this is not the first time that Biogen has seen its stock have this kind of volatility. In June of 2016, the shares dropped when a drug to treat multiple sclerosis failed. How easy is it for these pharma companies to recover when a drug like this doesn't end up working out?
You always have to strike a balance, especially for a corporation the size of Biogen. I mean, the balance is between research and development pipeline, which is speculative but potentially lucrative, with legacy franchises that need to be milked before generics are allowed in. And of course, if A and B fail, then you can go into mergers and acquisitions. And Biogen today just hemorrhaged $18 billion in market value. And this is for pulling a project that it was developing jointly with a Japanese pharmaceutical. So the stakes are enormous.
And I'm sure that one of the things that we will hear is, especially when it comes to drug prices in general, which are very high in this country, is that, you know, this is why they're high, because the drug companies have to put so much money into R&D and sometimes it doesn't work out. At the same time, taxpayers fund a lot of research that drug companies benefit from as well.
I think that's fair only up to a certain point. I mean, pharma and biotechs, they often spend lavishly on marketing, overhead, executive comp. Many established players pay nice dividends and buy stock back. It's not like 99 cents out of every dollar they make is going back into R&D. Mm-hmm. These are for-profit companies, which is why you also sometimes have to make these brutal decisions to cut losses in something that everyone really wanted to succeed.
That is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
A shelter-in-place order for a Houston suburb has now been lifted. Residents of Deer Park were told to stay indoors after a fire at a chemical plant this week released plumes of deadly smoke into the air. The fire burned for 3 days. It was put out yesterday, and officials had said the air around the city of Deer Park was safe to breathe. Then the shelter-in-place order and the Texas National Guard called in. Here's Harris County Judge Lena Hidalgo.
We've got Harris County Pollution Control, the Texas National Guard's 6th Civil Support Team, which are experts in chemical surveillance, Harris County Hazardous Material Team, City of Houston Hazmat Team. They've all set 2 perimeters around the incident site to identify and analyze air quality readings in real time.
Joining us now is Travis Bubenik, energy and environment reporter for Houston Public Media. Travis, early this morning, people were told they needed to wash off if they go outside, isolate any clothing they wore outside, and turn off the air conditioner. What changed?
Well, basically, officials say the levels of this toxin, benzene in particular, that spiked overnight and into this morning have since come back down to where they feel confident telling people you can go outside again.
What was burning at this chemical plant that made the smoke so toxic?
Well, what was burning was a bunch of different chemicals. You're talking about a complex of something like 15 huge chemical storage tanks. And these were components that were used in gasoline. Naphtha was one of them. I think xylene was another one. And there are some other names. But basically, petrochemicals that are used to make gasoline, to make nail polish, that kind of stuff, even glue, I think. Those were the components that have been burning over the last few days.
What are local officials there saying about why they said the air was safe yesterday and then all of a sudden this morning they said, nope, it's not?
Well, there's 2 different things going on here, and really officials are pointing to data. Now, the air quality data that the county, the state, and the feds were looking at in recent days as the fire was actually burning didn't show anything particularly alarming at ground level. The smoke basically was way up in the atmosphere. They said it was moving away thanks to winds. The weather was cooperating to where it didn't pose any air quality risks at the ground level. What changed late last night and into this morning was after the fire went out, you had these chemical storage tanks where basically the chemicals were now exposed to the air and the chemical vapors were going up into the air, creating different kinds of toxins going into the air. So the levels of those toxins, benzene in particular, spiked to above healthy levels early this morning, though they have since fallen back down.
What kind of scrutiny is the company that owns these storage tanks, ITC, going to be under now? And are there going to be new questions asked about how these kinds of chemicals are stored?
Well, state environmental regulators are certainly going to look at whether any fines need to be issued. Now, we should say in Texas that environmental groups have complained for years that fines on this industry that, you know, generates millions and billions of dollars of revenue are slaps on the wrist usually. So you're going to hear some conversation about that, whether fines should be stepped up. Whether that happens is a totally different question in Texas, of course. And then there's also going to be some lingering questions about what the longer-term health impacts of both the fire and the cleanup effort here and just the stuff that's sort of, you know, run off of this toxic site into local waterways, possibly into the bay might be. There's a big question that's still open about what happened to that big smoke cloud when it left the Houston region.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did it fall on other communities outside of Houston? Those are the kind of things that people are going to be looking at.
Yeah, there are reports now that the water in the Houston Ship Channel is now black. Travis Bubenik, energy and environment reporter for Houston Public Media, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
On Sunday, Lawrence Ferlinghetti turns 100. He's a poet who helped change the face of literary culture when he founded City Lights Bookstore and Publishing House in San Francisco back in the 1950s. He's marking his birthday with a new autobiographical novel. Here he is reading from Little Boy.
Little Boy was quite lost. He had no idea who he was or where he had come from.
As KQED's Chloe Veltman reports, in many ways, Ferlinghetti has always had the mischief of a little boy.
Until recently, Lawrence Ferlinghetti was vacationing in Mexico, popping into City Lights and working on poetry. But the last couple of years have taken their toll on his almost 100-year-old body. Ferlinghetti is nearly blind. He spends a lot of time in bed and no longer does in-person interviews.
There's an echo in my phone. I'm not getting your voice very clearly.
But as soon as his assistant adjusts the volume on our call, Ferlinghetti's like a Formula One driver, leaves me in the dust.
I have an engine that doesn't run on petroleum.
He says it runs on pure energy. Actually, Ferlinghetti is a lifelong critic of American car culture, calls it Autogeddon.
Autogeddon is sweeping the country, and there's no stopping it.
There's nothing that can be done?
Well, yes, there's things that can be done, but they would be revolutionary, and the United States isn't ready for revolution.
Ferlinghetti's rejection of capitalism, his doomsday worldview, drive his approach to life and literature. This is the best advice he has to offer the young.
Duck and run for cover.
I had an unhappy childhood. I saw Lindbergh land. I looked homeward and saw no angel.
You can hear the 1-2 punch of adult world weariness and childlike fun in this vintage recording of Ferlinghetti reciting an excerpt from his best-selling 1958 poetry collection, A Coney Island of the Mind.
I got caught stealing pencils from the 5- and 10-cent store the same month I made Eagle Scout.
Ferlinghetti was born in 1919 in Yonkers, New York. In his new book, Little Boy, the author talks about his early years in a distanced third-person voice.
He was with Aunt Emily, whom he loved very much.
About how this aunt had volunteered to raise him because his mother, who already had 4 sons, couldn't handle a fifth.
Born a few months after his father died of a heart attack.
Growing up, Ferlinghetti experienced extreme contrasts of wealth and poverty. But poetry has nearly always been in his life. Ferlinghetti came to California in 1950. He was drawn to it as a place where people could start over. It was what he called this country's last frontier. He launched City Lights in San Francisco in 1953 with a mission to break poetry out of its stuffy academic cage and make it accessible to all. It was a massive risk.
We were young and foolish.
Unlike other bookstores around the country, City Lights was open 7 days a week and late into the night. He wanted to create a sense of community, a place for people to toss around ideas. And the business was originally focused on selling paperback books at a time when the literary establishment only cared about hardbacks.
Paperbacks weren't considered as real books. The only paperback books were murder mysteries and some science fiction books.
But Ferlinghetti was all about democratizing literature. City Lights weathered its fair share of ups and downs over the years, like Ferlinghetti's arrest in 1957 on obscenity charges for publishing Allen Ginsberg's groundbreaking epic poem Howl.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix.
City Light's current publisher and director, Elaine Katzenberger, says the business continues to draw customers from all over the world, despite challenges in the industry.
We don't have bestsellers, and we're not publishing bestsellers. And so staying true to those ideals and maintaining them, that's the hardest thing. And on the other hand, it's the most important thing.
Katzenberger shows me into Ferlinghetti's old corner office upstairs at City Lights. She flips through his Rolodex. A veritable who's who of 20th century literary life.
Studs Terkel, Jack Hirschman, of course, Vincent Farini, Saul Zantz, Mrs. John Dos Passos.
Ferlinghetti's status as a literary institution is palpable. It's no wonder there's a street named after him, and the mayor of San Francisco has proclaimed his birthday March 24th, Lawrence Ferlinghetti Day. I ask Ferlinghetti if he's proud of his many accomplishments.
I don't know that word proud. It's just too egotistic.
So how about happy?
Yeah, happy would be better, except when you get down to try and define the word happy, then you're really in trouble.
Instead of all the fuss around his big upcoming birthday, this near centenarian laughs and says he'd rather discuss what it would take to start a revolution. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman in San Francisco.
And let's talk now about an idea that's been central to American life since the country's founding and been contested for almost as long, civility, and who gets to define it. All this month, NPR has been looking at the role of civility in this polarizing time. Gene Demby of NPR's Code Switch podcast is here to talk about one strain of thought that intersects with civility, the politics of respectability. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. And this is fascinating. Civility, we know about the way people should conduct themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But respectability has been given another meaning. What is that?
Right. So if civility is sort of about the way people interact with each other in public, right, sort of the rules of engagement, respectability has this added layer of being watched. So it's the idea that if you belong to a group that's, you know, historically been pushed to the sides, in this case, African-Americans, that your public comportment has consequences for the larger group, right? Negative and positive. So there's this whole universe of behaviors called the politics of respectability, in which sort of the uplift of African Americans or other marginalized groups is sort of weaponized through this lens, right? You're trying to put your best face forward all the time with the hopes that it helps get you traction and legitimacy with the wider and wider world.
Yeah, and now everyone, as you say, from Booker T. Washington to Barack Obama, from historically black colleges to the Nation of Islam, has some version of these politics. So give us some examples.
Right. I mean, Barack Obama just recently gave a speech to an organization that mentors black men and boys, and he admonished them about the way they dressed, and he talked to them about the ways they should carry themselves in public. A good example is the civil rights movement. I spoke to Randall Kennedy, who is a Harvard law professor, who is a defender of these politics, and he's written about the way the Montgomery bus boycotts were organized around respectability politics.
In Martin Luther King Jr.'s first speech as a civil rights leader, he talked about the importance of their standard bearer. Their standard bearer was Rosa Parks. And he said, you know, I'm sorry that anybody had to go through this, but if there was anybody who was going to be our standard bearer, it's good that it's Rosa Parks, because everybody knows what kind of person she is.
And Randall Kennedy says, like, look, all marginalized groups, especially groups that are treated with hostility, need to win over allies to the cause. And respectability is the way you do this. And you can see this in today's debates about, you know, immigration, right? Like, if you look at DACA and the conversation around the Dreamers, the reason those young people were the early faces of this current immigration debate is because they are the least offensive, right? They are college students. They're, as people say about the DACA recipients, people who came to the United States at a really young age through no fault of their own. So these are sort of the less thorny examples of people who are impacted by immigration policy here in the States.
Well, so that's, you know, the politics is respectability, but you say there are some caveats to this.
Right. Well, if we just follow those examples, right, if there are good faces for these movements, then there are necessarily people whose biographies are not nearly as presentable, right? Rosa Parks was not the first person to sit down on one of those buses, right? She was preceded by a woman named Claudette Colvin, who was from a working class family. She was also a teenager. She got pregnant not long after she was arrested. She was also darker skinned. And so she didn't present to the wider world the face that the civil rights movement felt was the most attractive and that they thought would be the most attractive to white people. And so part of the problem is that inside of these marginalized groups, there are people who become even more marginalized by the narratives around respectability.
Yeah. Well, and there's something called victim blaming.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, some of the early proponents of respectability, they criticized things like jazz, right? They criticized the blues because of the kinds of black people who hung out in jazz clubs and blues clubs. They thought that those, you know, art forms didn't help the cause of black people because they made black people look bad, right? And this, you could see the same conversations around hip-hop. And this has always been part of the conversation around respectability. Like, even in the early 20th century, you know, that's the peak of spectacle lynching. And it was not uncommon to see black pastors and black civic leaders criticizing people who were victims of lynchings for their own victimization, saying that they'd behaved in ways that brought those eventualities upon themselves.
There's also Trayvon Martin blamed for his own shooting because he had a hoodie. You spoke to a political scientist at Stanford, Hakeem Jefferson, who's been measuring how much this respectability shapes black public opinion on things like the justice system and the welfare programs. And he says quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. He argues that this is hardly a fringe position, that this is a powerful undercurrent in black American political life. And that, you know, black people often really want the folks who are behaving badly, however that is defined, to be punished, right? And this isn't a fringe position. In his research, he found about two-thirds of respondents, his respondents were all black, by the way, who expressed some sympathy to the idea that punishing behavior that wasn't respectable was a good thing because of the feeling that the behavior has consequences for everyone else. Mm.
But then you have pushback on this. You've got Black Lives Matter.
Right. And, you know, part of the story of groups like Black Lives Matter is that they reject respectability politics, right? And you can see that in the makeup of their political coalition, right? It's they're the kind of people in that movement that might have been sidelined in other movements, right? So you have poor black people who make up the organizing base of that movement. You have queer black people who were the face of that movement. And so in a lot of ways, Black Lives Matter is not just a response to white supremacy writ large, but also a response to the kinds of black people who have been left out of the conversation about which black lives matter.
Yeah. Boy, a respectability as a positive force and then maybe a negative one when people weren't respectable enough. Gene Demby, co-host of the Code Switch podcast on NPR. Thanks for helping us take a look at it as we look at civility in general. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And we'll link you to NPR's other stories on civility at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.